Welcome to the Heroic Investing Show. As first responders, we risk our lives every day. Our financial security is under attack. Our pensions are in a state of emergency. A single on-duty incident can alter or erase our earning potential instantly and forever. We are the heroes of society. We are self-reliant and we need to take care of our own financial future. The Heroic Investing Show is our toolkit of business and investing tactics on our mission to financial freedom.
Welcome to the Heroic Investing Show, where we talk about financial strategies for first responders. You guys are risking your life out there every day, and we want to make sure that you have a good retirement and a good financial plan. That's what the Heroic Investing Show is all about. So we've got a great show for you today, and we will be back with our guest in just a moment.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn more about investing in real estate in different markets, there's a show for that. If you want to learn 17 ways rich people think and act differently, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to get paid to borrow, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know why Amsterdam doesn't take dollars or why pools are for fools, there are even shows for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
It's my pleasure to welcome Devin Guzman to the show. He's a personal friend of mine, and he's back on for another chat with us today. He's a retired police officer with 24 years of service, and with the recent memorial of the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we want to talk about first responders and how they can be more prepared, as we do on the show with every episode. So, Devin, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jason. It's good to be back. How are you?
Good, thanks. So, you are in Long Beach, California, and I'm in Tempe, Arizona, as we record this, and 9/11, what are your thoughts?
Well, as I look back on it, that particular time, I remember I was still obviously a part of the Torrance Police Department. I was actively being trained in what they call SEMS, or Emergency Management Systems. That was a big push for all the agencies. And what you learned from that was basically what you didn't know and how to implement disaster strategies and preparedness. And what I think most shockingly came out of 9/11, other than the attacks themselves, was how unprepared we really were as a nation, not only for that event, but on a national level, but on regional and a local level, just cooperation and the logistics required to facilitate that event were staggering.
It really was amazing how the intelligence, this is not really the topic of the show, so we won't get into it too deeply. Obviously, there are people who are really experts who spend their whole life studying this stuff, but how the intelligence agencies didn't really share information very well at the time, and hopefully they do a lot better job of that nowadays, right?
Yeah, well, like you said, I think that was a cultural phenomenon within not only federal agencies, but state and local governments didn't really have, for example, they didn't even have radios that could really communicate to each other. Somewhere on different megahertz channels, and they couldn't get information to each other. And as you know, you and I both know, and that's why we have the show, is information is knowledge, and knowledge is wisdom, and wisdom is power. So I mean, they couldn't even communicate effectively to each other. How are they going to manage their situation?
That's for sure. And it's just such a terrible tragedy, of course, for the first responders mostly, and for the families as well, of course. And everybody just came to work that day thinking it was just a normal day, and look how things changed. So we're here to talk about the financial aspect and the strategies, financial strategies for first responders. And in the wake of the 9/11 tragedy, what really everybody has to remember is you never know what's going to happen. And that's why it's so important to plan for your own future, of course, but for your family's future in case you're not there for them. What are your thoughts? I mean, you're in the real estate business now, and you work with investors, Devin. I work with investors all the time. And you know, what are your thoughts about first responders and how they can better prepare for their financial future?
They give you very, very little training when you get out of the police academy on how to manage your finances. They do a lot of training for how to handle a bad guy in the street. They do a lot of about how to minimize your exposure to risk as far as lawsuits, not only for yourself, but for the city. But they don't do a very good job at all about preparing you on the eventual outcome of either your retirement or something that would be your own personal 9/11 a tragedy that would force you out of work or to the sidelines. And as anybody that's in that field knows, whether you're a National Guardsman, whether you're a police officer, fireman, what have you, you're one incident away from that eventuality. And that's just reality. And if you're not prepared, if you don't even know how to prepare, it can be pretty shocking, the results.
It sure can. So what do you think when you look at different investments out there, real estate, stocks, bonds, mutual funds? I have just always felt, firmly believe, that the most historically proven asset class is simple rental property investment. It has universal need. And I say take your public pension and privatize it through real estate investments. That is, in my opinion, the way to go for first responders. These pensions are under attack. I mean, the public is just upset about some of these overly generous pensions, but most people don't have that. But of course, they're kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The government is basically broke at the national, state, and local level in almost every state and place that you look. Do you think these pensions are likely to happen if their retirement is 20 years from now, for example? I mean, will there be any money to pay?
It's a really good question. And Jason, I was blowing this trumpet. I did contract negotiations for all the departments I was ever involved with. And I was always on the board, which is, it's not really a union. Most police departments are not allowed to have a union by law because they're just not allowed to have them. So you can have associations and they basically go out and do the contract negotiations. And years ago, we were telling the guys, look, you cannot build your life around overtime. You cannot build your life around perpetual 10, 12, 15% contracts over 4 or 5 years. It's just, it, like you said, trees don't grow to the sky. And the problem is that when you're working with an agency or entities, whether the federal government or the city, they're not paying as close attention to the bottom line as you are being a private business owner. They're not as worried because it just, the money comes in month after month, regardless of what they do, or so they thought. And that day of reckoning has come, and it's still coming to these cities where they don't have increasing revenues. They don't have skyrocketing property taxes. They don't have streams of income coming in through building permits and things like that that help fund. Most police departments, I don't know if you're aware of this, Jason, are over 50% of a city's general fund. That's very expensive to run a police department. You lump the fire department into it, you're probably at 70% of a general fund for a city just for salaries and retirements. That just can't continue, and it's bearing out. So your question about 20 years from now, I think it's a very uncertain area as to where, and CalPERS is the largest in the country, in the world, and they're having problems.
Well, and you mentioned CalPERS, which is a really salient point, because if we have any people who are listening to this in California or in the few other states that are really, really in trouble, like California, I think you've got to pay really special attention to this, because California is a fiscal disaster, and the likelihood of budget problems and just wait. When we talk about 20 years in the future, you look at the out-migration of productive people leaving the state of California, and basically the government has invited them to leave. They're incentivizing them to leave because they're just too intrusive and too overbearing in so many ways in terms of the regulatory environment, too expensive to employ people, so the jobs are leaving. So people are leaving, and there will be less and less to fund the future obligations of a state like California. And so it's really a vicious circle. It's a downward spiral. And it is very critical that first responders listen to this.
No, absolutely. And then you lump into that the real life situation that there's a very high probability that you're going to suffer some kind of an injury while on the job. There's a lot of presumptive injuries, heart problems, back problems. Those are presumptive in the state of California after a certain period of time, which means they just assume that the cities have thrown in the towel on those deals and said, we know that this is going to get injured on you. So think about that for a minute, that they know it, and they're not in the habit of just giving you carte blanche or just like an attorney just saying, you know, I agree to that. You're going to get hurt. You're going to have a period of time where you may not be able to work either short term or permanently. And to think that you better plan on living on 50% of your salary or less when that happens.
Now, you were injured on the job when you were making an arrest. Do you care to talk about your personal situation?
I don't mean to spring this on you. I'd like to be, that's why we're on this show, and I think it's a very important point.
So tell the listeners what happened to you.
without going into a great amount of detail, I mean, I'd been pretty much injury free for 22 years of my career. A couple little, you know, dents and dings there, but nothing too terrible. And it was a high school football game, and there was an altercation I had with a suspect who ended up having a firearm, and it was a struggle for that. And in the course of that, I sustained some pretty significant injuries to the shoulder, and a couple surgeries later, it precluded me from continuing in the job, and you know, I had to look for other options for me.
And so it wasn't easy for you to get the benefits, though, that you were entitled to from the department, was it?
No. And it's something that you can preach, and I used to preach to the guys all the time, is you have to understand something, that cities or corporations, for the vast majority of them, they're just businesses. And the police department is a division or an offshoot of that corporation. And they don't really care how popular you are in your little division. You can be the greatest guy or gal in the world. Bottom line is there's somebody else over at City Hall or an attorney firm or what have you, risk management firm, that's got a sharp pencil. And when you don't fit or you're no longer profitable for them, they got to make a business decision of whether or not they're going to keep you or provide a service. And if they're self-insured, you see a lot of these cities are self-insured, they don't want to write a check and be on the hook for a lifetime injury, regardless of how much deserving you may or may not be about it. That's irrelevant to them. Frankly, they'll say it is, but when the bottom line comes down, they really don't want to do it. They'll do it, but you got to fight for it.
Well, it's just like any insurance company. You know, we see this all the time, and this is why I say to investors, when we're talking, just to use a kind of real estate comparison here, I always say that the best insurance is a high loan balance. And I know that's counterintuitive, and people don't on the face of it believe it. But if you look at, say, during Hurricane Katrina, for example, there were huge insurance losses and lots of claims came in after the hurricane damage, and the insurance companies were just denying claims. They were whittling them down to nothing and not paying people based on their policies. And the court history, it's just riddled with what we call insurance bad faith. And insurance companies, just like you say, their businesses, if a department, a police department or a fire department is self-insured, they don't want to pay claims, and you can't blame them. They're just trying to keep their costs under control. And so whether they're self-insured or they've outsourced it to another company, an insurance company, you're going to have to fight for your benefits most of the time, aren't you?
Well, yeah, and just we need to have some, you know, this show's about realism. It's not about fantasy land. We all know, and I'll say, when I'm speaking, I'm speaking as a retired, you know, police officer to my fellow first responders out there. We all know people that have taken advantage of the system. I mean, that's just human nature. Out of 100 people, 98 of them are going to be just the most honest, hardworking, but, you know, there's a couple that aren't. And everybody suffers for that, and they have to treat every case like it's a fraudulent case, because there's so many people that are trying to take advantage of the system because of what have you. So you need to be prepared for that, and knowing going into it that you may be righteously injured or may have a righteous claim, even if it's a cancer or something like that, that's completely out of you're going to have to be prepared for an arduous battle to get your benefits. And so to tie it back into the kind of the topic of the show, is that's one of those personal 9/11 things. You don't know when you're, perfect example. We have a guy that we worked with at Torrance, young guy, I won't use his name because I don't have permission to, came to work one day, and literally we were teasing him in the locker room because he looked a little yellow. We were teasing him, hey, did you drink too much tequila last night? And just, you know, good natured locker room stuff. A couple of days later, he still looked pretty bad. He literally ended up having Hodgkin's, and he died. But a couple years later, he went through a bunch of different chemo treatments, battled super courageously, but he ended up succumbing to it. Now, the department was just angelic to him, and so was the city. And they treated him, and rightfully so. And everything was done within their power to take care of him. The point is that he didn't know coming to work on that day that was his personal 9/11. He had no idea that was coming. And isn't it an extreme example? I don't necessarily think so, because none of us really know, you know, when something like that's going to happen.
Yeah, it's really true. So let's talk about real estate for a moment. But this is all the reasons why first responders need to be prepared and need to have their own financial backup plan and not depend on the powers that be, the city, the department, et cetera. So when we look at real estate, I mean, It's just such a simple thing. It's just beautifully simple. And a great place for everybody to start is just get yourself a couple of single-family homes, single-family detached homes, ideally not condos, because when you have condos and homeowners associations that have a lot of control over the property, you're delegating power to another entity that may or may not be decent, that may or may not be well-managed, that the board of directors can abscond with the money, all sorts of problems can occur in homeowners associations, and I've seen it throughout the years. So I just like simple little single-family homes. Keep it really simple and uncomplicated. Diversify. Don't just be in your own market, and maybe you shouldn't be in your own market at all if your market is a place that doesn't make sense to invest. And the cardinal rule, the first cut, I say, in terms of evaluating an investment, is just simply look at what we call the RV ratio, the rent-to-value ratio, which should be at least right now in this current market, and this is subject to a little bit of change depending on market dynamics, but as of today, should be at least 1% of the value. And this is a very, very simple metric. It's not the only thing to consider, of course. There are many other metrics, but this is the first one. So, for example, and I'll just use round numbers to make it simple, a $100,000 property should rent for at least $1,000 per month, 1% of the value of the property. So that RV or rent-to-value ratio would be 1% in that case. And that's just a quick rule of thumb how people can evaluate it. So we're talking about California, where we're both from. I grew up in West Los Angeles, and then my adult life lived in Orange County until moving to Arizona just recently. And it just doesn't work in that market for single family, because you can't get 1%. You get a lot less than 1%. And ideally, you'd get more than 1% RV ratio. So it doesn't work there. But if someone's listening to this in a market in Arizona, Texas, Georgia, there are many markets around the country that it does work, where you can get RV ratios of, say, 1.2 or 1.4%, which is fantastic. So in that example, a $100,000 property is renting for $1,200 to $1,400 per month. And that'll give you an excellent return on investment. What do you think about the RV ratios? And you know, talk about any of the other metrics you want to bring up.
Well, I think that the way you've broken it down, I mean, Jason, for the novice investor, or even a sophisticated investor, you've really done a great job of boiling it down to something that is more easily understandable. You can go into all the cap rates and what they call internal rates of return and all these different, those are really for super sophisticated hedge funds. And some of them don't even really mean anything depending on the input numbers. I mean, it can all be kind of manipulated, and it's a lot of stuff to digest. The stuff you put out on Trading Wealth and Heroic Investing and the workshops is pretty much for either an investor that's looking to get started in the business, or maybe has some experience but really doesn't know how to apply it concise. They've got too much information. I completely agree that real estate is probably the best, and not, I wouldn't say quickest, but if you want to say quickest in the respect of learning curve and being able to apply it immediately of all the different investments, bond markets, gold, you know, other types of annuities, they're pretty complex. They try to make them sound simple, but nothing easier than a single family house on a piece of land that's got a rent stream coming from it. It's pretty basic.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Have you listened to the Creating Wealth series? I mean, from the beginning. If not, you can go ahead and get book one, that shows 1 through 20 in digital download. These are advanced strategies for wealth creation. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com.
The other really important principle that I say is that, and this is critically important, if it doesn't produce income, it should never be considered an investment. Now, what do I mean by that? If you buy a stock that is a non-dividend paying stock, or you buy gold or silver or platinum or palladium or anything that doesn't produce income, vacant land would be an example, doesn't produce income. That is not an investment. That is a speculation. That is a gamble. Now, granted, people have made money in those things, there's no question, and you can make money in them, but more often than not, you're getting lucky. And, you know, I always say jokingly, but also seriously, I'd rather be lucky than good any day of the week, okay? So luck is a wonderful thing. The problem is you can't rely on it. So since I can't be lucky all the time, I'm going to be good. And to be good, you got to invest in things that produce income. Otherwise, you're a gambler. You're a speculator.
Well, and you know, Jason, beyond that, too, I should say in conjunction with that, is the learning curve to be proficient in that and the amount of time that it really takes, despite what some of the shows will tell you on TV. If you don't have your finger on the button, literally, and know how to get in and out of a trade, the long-term ability for stocks to make you money, it's, in my experience, it's pretty hit and miss. You've got to get pretty lucky unless you were in the big behemoths of the day, the P&Gs, the Procter & Gambles, the old guards like that. They move so slowly now, Walmarts, that your upside on them is extremely limited just because of their sheer size. And trying to identify the new emerging Walmart or thing is so much risk in it that the downside's almost not worth it.
There sure is. And just remember, one of the terms that people should be familiar with, or I should say phrases, people should be familiar with in the investment and financial world is what they call counterparty risk. So what that means is the counterparty is the person on the other side of the table, the opposite side of that transaction. So for every buyer, there has to be a seller. For every seller, there has to be a buyer. That's your counterparty. But when it comes to traded assets, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, any sort of pooled money investment where you're putting your money into something that someone else is controlling, you have a whole nother set of risk. And I call that, and I made this one up so far as I know, I call it the intermediary party risk. Okay, and the intermediary party is the person who's in between you and the counterparty. So when you look at a stock, you've got all of these intermediaries in there, don't you? You've got the CEO of the company, you got the board of directors, you've got the brokerage house, the investment bank. There's just all of these intermediary, all these rainmakers and middlemen on Wall Street and all this kind of stuff. When you're in a like an LLC or some sort of pooled money investment in a fund or a mutual fund, you have the fund manager. They're the intermediary party. And so you've got risk before you even get to the person on the other side of the table, the counterparty, right? The buyer or the seller that has to buy your asset so you can make a profit, right? And that's the thing I love about income property is it's just you get those intermediary parties out of the deal. Of course, you always have a counterparty. There is no investment that doesn't have a counterparty, no business that doesn't have a counterparty. If you're in business, you could look at your vendors and employees and customers as your counterparty in a way. Now, hopefully, it's not an adversarial relationship, but they've got to buy what you're selling at some level, right?
Absolutely. And Jason, one of the things, I forget, I don't remember them off the top of my head. You used to drill them into me, but on your 10 commandments of investing, I think that's number 3, thou shalt maintain control.
Right. You remembered it well. Yes.
You know, and if you don't control it, we preach that here. You know, I do large commercial investments, whatever large means. But if you don't control the deal, and that sounds bad to people, you know, outside of what Jason and I, or what Jason used to predominantly do, and what I kind of do now, is if you're not in charge of the deal, there is no deal. You're spinning your wheels. You may as well go to the beach that day and hit some golf balls because it's not going to happen. If you don't know what's going on with that company, I don't care if it's even Apple. Nobody knew really what was going on with Steve Jobs. Nobody still really knows. And I love Apple. It's the only company I really trust.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree
but
more.
Even you know? That is an unknown. And that's probably the most stable thing we got going.
It is an unknown. You're absolutely right, Devin. It's amazing. If anyone wants to pick up the book War on the Middle Class, that is just by Lou Dobbs, War on the Middle Class. Great book. And in chapter 2, he gives a lot of examples in the stock market. I'll just share a couple of them with the listeners here because it is mind-boggling, Devin. When you look at these intermediary parties, the CEOs and the boards of directors, it's incredible. The greed on Wall Street, it's disgusting. It really is. So look at this example. Terry Semel, chairman and CEO of Yahoo at the time, okay, and this is a couple years ago when he wrote the book, was paid $120 million in 2004. Lou Frankfurt, head of Coach, was paid $58 million in 2002. Robert Nardelli, CEO, the infamous CEO of Home Depot, made $36 million. Ed Zander of Motorola made $32 million. Meg Whitman, of course, of eBay at the time, $26 million. Now, that's fine, right? I'm a capitalist. I'm all for people making as much money as they can. I think that's wonderful. The problem is, though, when they're making it on your back as the investor, that is not fair. So Lou Dobbs goes on to say in the book, he says, the standard rationalization for these astronomical salaries by CEOs, their boards of directors, and their consultants, which are usually their fraternity buddies and family members and their friends, right? Nepotism galore, is that these CEOs are worth it because the companies they run benefit from their leadership and they bring great value to their shareholders. How then do they explain, Dobbs goes on to say in the book, the fact that over the past 5 years, the CEOs of AT&T, Bell South, Hewlett-Packard, Home Depot, Lucent, Merck, Pfizer, Safeway, Time Warner, Verizon, and Walmart were paid an aggregate of $865 million. Just let's remember, that's almost $1 billion with a B, those CEOs. And that's just a small group of them. $865 million while their shareholders lost $640 billion, billion with a B. Clearly, these CEOs were not being paid for delivering value to their shareholders. What do you think of that? I got one more example after that, but I want to let you just talk because I'm sure you have something to say.
I've been on both sides of that, not a CEO or anything, but now owning my own small little business and having to invest in it and having worked for some other companies raising capital and doing things like that. I have seen exactly what you're talking about. And unfortunately, there's a lot of businesses in the country that are run exceptionally well and they do everything they possibly can to make a profit. But as we both know, business is business and you don't know. It goes back to that. You don't have control of it. You don't know what the skimming is. And I call it skimming. It just really is what the soft cost benefits that are going to these different groups and advisors really are. And that's eating into profits of your quote unquote stock that isn't making it might seem small on the top line revenues, but it's really not because it's happening throughout the company if it's happening at the top levels.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. So commandment number 3 of my 10 commandments of successful investing, you can get that online, heroicinvesting.com. Thou shalt maintain control. So the last example on this one I want to give you, Devin, is, and then Lou Dobbs goes on to say in the book War on the Middle Class, and then there's Larry Ellison, founder and CEO of, everybody knows, Oracle. From 2000 to 2002, that's in 2 short years, in 24 months, Larry's personal take from the company was $781 million in 2 years. That's almost $1 billion in 2 years. But shareholder return was negative 61% in that same 2 years. I mean, doesn't that just blow your mind? We've got to stop giving up control of our investments. We've got to retain the profit for ourselves. So maintain control, be a direct investor. Just buy some simple little houses, work your way up. Maybe you're listening to this and you're an advanced investor and you've done this plan already and you've benefited from it over the years because you bought properties that made sense the day you buy them. And that does not include Southern California or anywhere in California in 2005, just so you know, because that never made sense, okay? That was always out of proportion and illogical. But if you bought properties that made sense the day you bought them and held them for a few years, maybe you've worked your way up and now you're ready to jump up and transition from single family homes to getting a 24 unit apartment building or a 56 unit apartment building. I'm just throwing out random numbers here, but it's amazing how that happens. I mean, I've done single family homes for just over 20 years. And recently, Devin, as you know, I bought a 125 unit apartment building with a client of ours. And I mean, it's just amazing how the years go by, whether you notice or not. And you look back and it's like, boy, those 2 decades just flew by, didn't they?
Well, I don't think you'd mind me, you know, throwing out there. I work in the apartment field primarily. I do commercial investments, all sorts of commercial investments, but primarily apartments. And I have a client, the CPA, a high-end CPA. And what I mean by that is he's a very esoteric CPA, does different types of insurance company audits. So he's sophisticated. His family has 3 small little apartment buildings that they bought over 30 years ago. And I'm in the process of completing what's called a 1031 exchange. For the listeners out there that don't know what that is, it's basically a way to defer tax your gain on the building into another building. We're buying them probably a 40 to 50 unit building here in Southern California, which is where they want to stay. And they're going to go from a non-depreciable, you know, asset that has very little upside left into them, into a beautiful beachside 44-unit building with a brand new depreciation schedule and a lot of upside, and all with no tax consequence to them. And that's the magic of long-term buying well and holding and then trading up.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's another one of the Ten Commandments of successful investing. What we say is thou shalt only invest in tax-favored assets. And income property is the most tax-favored asset in America. And Devin, what you're doing for your client there is you're doing a 1031 tax-deferred exchange. You can trade income property your whole life and never pay tax. And then your estate doesn't have to pay tax on it either if you plan correctly, because the basis steps up to market value at the time of death. So it is just, there is just nothing more powerful than this in terms of a tax planning vehicle. A lot of people might be listening now, and maybe they're listening while they're in the patrol car, whatever. And they're thinking, well, taxes, that's such a boring subject. But taxes are not boring. Taxes are the single largest expense in anybody's life. And whether we are interested in this topic or not, we had better learn about taxation and better learn how to do the things that the government is incentivizing us to do so we can minimize our tax bill. And they're incentivizing us to own rental property and provide rental housing to people. It's one of those sacred things in the tax code, and we should maximize that as much as possible, shouldn't we?
Well, absolutely. And I think everybody out there is probably familiar with one of your and I favorite movies out there is Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, and great movie, yeah.
In that one seminal scene where Robbins is going to get ready to be thrown off the building because he asks the really nasty prison guard if he trusts his wife. And he almost ready to throw him off the building. He says, because I can save you a bunch of money if we do this tax. And just by talking to those prison guards, he ended up saving them and building them a bunch of wealth because, yeah, they didn't understand tax. That's not their job. That's why we created this show. They didn't understand that the benefits were available to the wealthy or the other educated is what I like to call it now, because they just haven't, most of the people in our profession have just not been availed to that education or that world. They don't know that these benefits are available for them just as it is for corporations. If they take advantage of it, right? Start doing things with a business mindset, buying little properties and taking advantage of the tax code. And by mean taking full advantage of everything that's available to you lawfully, and then leveraging that and deploying it back into more assets. And that's how you're going to get ahead. That's how you're going to build.
Absolutely. Great advice. Well, we're out of time for this one, but Devin, of course, we'll have you back on the show many times in the future. But one more thing before we go, I'd just like to talk about, you are working on a great guest that you have referred to the show that we're really looking forward to having on, who is a workers' comp attorney. And why don't you talk about that a little bit and how it applies to first responders? So, so important.
Sure. Part of that theme for this 9/11 show was, you know, your personal 9/11. And I had to learn, unfortunately, the hard way, that sometimes the very people in our profession that we go up against, sometimes in court, these attorneys, you have to employ them as advocates, because when you go into this arena, you're really going against, when I'm talking about workman's comp or an injury, you're really going up against a city or a corporation or a county or sometimes even a state if you're like a federal or a state officer, like a highway patrolman in some areas, state troopers. To go into that battle without a good lieutenant is really foolish, because nobody's going to be your advocate. You have to protect yourself. And to not do that is really not only putting your family in jeopardy, but putting your health at jeopardy. Obviously, you have to choose a good one, just like any professional. And the firm that represents me, I'm proud to say, is a very good and reputable firm, and they've been in the business for a lot of years. And the one of the partners has agreed to come on the show and not only talk about the current state of what he sees in the economy, because he's dealing with the cities on a daily basis.
He knows how financially strapped they are, most of them, right? Yeah,
absolutely, because he's in contact with the city managers. He's in contact with the attorneys that represent the city. He's a wealth of knowledge, and he'd be the first person to tell you, hey, if you don't need representation, you know, if you scratch your finger, that's different. If you break your back, you're pretty much foolish if you don't get counsel to help you through the system because it's a quagmire.
Good point. Well, thank you again for referring him to the show, and we really look forward to having him on, hopefully the next episode or the one after that. But Devin Guzman, 24 years of service as a police officer in Southern California, thank you so much again for joining us today. And any final words you want people to hear before you go?
No, just make it a habit, like anything, to tune into the show and to download the episodes onto your iPods or iPhones, because that's what it was created for, and start creating that knowledge base so that you can become a knowledgeable and powerful investor.
And please refer your colleagues and coworkers to this show as well, because it's really important that everybody understand this stuff, and especially as it applies to first responders. So thanks so much for joining us today, everybody, and happy investing to you. Check out the website at heroicinvesting.com. That's heroicinvesting.com.
You know, Penny, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Rich. Jason actually has a 6-book set on creating wealth that comes with over 100 hours of the most comprehensive ideas on investing in business. They're in high-quality digital download audio format, ready for your car, iPod, or wherever you want to learn.
Yes, and by the way, he's recently added another book to the series that shows you investing the way it should be. This is a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Jason actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets that are untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches us how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
He's recorded interviews with Harry Dent, Peter Schiff, Robert Kiyosaki, Pat Buchanan, Catherine Austin Fitz, Dr. Dennis Waitley, T. Harv Eker, and so many others who are experts on the economy, on real estate, and on creating wealth.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered with a savings of $385.
Now, to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series complete with over 100 hours of audio and 6 books, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.